Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, November 15th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Sean Baker's newest movie, Enora, and present an interview with writer-director Sean Baker. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
All right. Apologies for not having an episode yesterday. We're kind of ramping up the number of articles that we publish at Slash Film. So our responsibilities at the site have us stretched a little thinner than usual. So I just kind of dropped the ball yesterday. But I'm very excited, Jacob, to finally talk to you about this movie, because I was actually planning on running Bill Bria's interview with Sean Baker today, even though I hadn't had a chance to see the film yet, just because it's been several weeks since that interview was conducted, and I was kind of resigned to just waiting until this movie finally hit streaming to watch it, because it just looked like the rollout was never going to make it to my area in Northeast Florida. But thankfully, I happened to check my local listings and see that it had expanded to a theater close enough to me where I could go see it. So I watched it last night. I know you reviewed this at a Fantastic Fest and you called it the best movie of the year. With a little distance, what do you think about Enora? Do you still stand by that proclamation?
Well, since I saw Fantastic Fest, you know, people would talk about the film festival bubble, about how people have ecstatic reactions at a festival, then a more muted reaction later. I don't necessarily think that's always true, but it is a phenomenon that does exist. But I've seen Enora three times now, and it's the best film of the year.
Wow. Okay. All right. So I want to talk to you sort of broadly about it, and then we can get into spoilers. So just to kick things off,
before you do that, do you agree? Did you love as much as I did, or did you like it? I would love to know your basic opinion going into this.
I think it's the funniest movie of 2024. I don't know, because it's such a whirlwind of a film that I literally just saw it last night, like pretty late in the night, and then woke up and haven't done anything yet. So I'm still kind of processing the movie, and you know, in the coming days, it might rise up my personal rankings, but like, just on a gut level, I think there are a couple movies that I liked a little bit more than this one this year. So I'm not fully ready to anoint it with that same level of praise. But I do think it's a great movie. I think it's my favorite of Sean Baker's movies by far, because I was actually like on the outside looking in when it comes to The Florida Project, which I know like everyone in the world loved. And I was just kind of like, there was something about that movie that didn't quite land for me. But yeah, I liked it a lot. I just don't know if I'm like fully head over heels in love with it. But I will say, I laughed so much throughout this movie that it was kind of a real joy to watch, despite being a little bit of a bummer of a movie in some ways. So what did you think about like the tone of the film?
Yeah, the tone is really interesting. And interesting to describe as a bummer, because the more I watch it, the more optimistic of a film I think it is at the end. Because there's the main character, Enora, who, for those who don't know, this movie's about a sex worker played by Mikey Madison, who elopes with one of her clients, this extremely wealthy, very young Russian son of an oligarch, essentially, and about the fallout when his very wealthy billionaire family figures out about this marriage and tries to take it apart. And what happens from there is, I don't want to spoil how it rolls out, because it is not what you expect it is, and the trailers do a good job of not selling the best parts of the movie. But the tone is, you know, it is dark at times, because this is a film about, you know, how we're all pawns of billionaires. That's literally everybody in this movie is doing a job, and everybody in this movie is being screwed by the person above them. Sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively. But this film is full of people, of workers, sex workers, you know, menial job workers, people in various positions of authority or non-authority. Everybody in this movie is at the whim of somebody else, and nobody's having a good time because of it. And that's a dark thought. It's very much a mirror being held up to, you know, a world where everybody's lives are overtaken by their jobs define their existences, and their boss defines their happiness. And that's running throughout all of Enora. Every single scene of Enora is about that in some way. But it also has the energy of, I wrote this in my review, so I'm going to paraphrase myself here. What if a Howard Hawks comedy from 1930s with Captain Hepburn and Cary Grant was also Uncut Gems? It's kind of the tone here, Ben, is kind of what I how I describe it.
Yeah, 100%. And that's my favorite part of the movie. Like, the sort of madcap tone and the manic energy that this film has is just incredible, and kind of it gave me life, so to speak. Like, I was just like feeding on the movie's energy in such an entertaining way. And then it kind of, there will be moments where it takes a little bit of a darker turn, or that those themes that you're talking about come more to the forefront of the movie, and you kind of get hit with these waves of realization of, like, despite how fun this movie is in several aspects, there's this underlying element to it where it's almost a tragedy in certain senses. So it's a really tonally interesting movie, and I'm not 100% convinced, especially that the ending really, really worked for me. I like going out on the note that this movie goes out on, I thought was an interesting choice given the tone for the majority of the rest of the movie. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. But before we get into spoilers, any other sort of broad statements that you want to make about this movie?
Mikey Madison is incredible. I've seen her in other things. She was in one of the most recent Scream movies, for instance. She had a small role, a memorable role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as one of the Manson followers. But man, what a transformative role. Like, I'm instantly so excited to see what Mikey Madison does next. Just entire film is built around her, and she's surrounded, you know, this movie has no big names in it. She's the biggest name. Even then, she's not really a really known commodity. Mm-hmm. But she carries this movie, and the rest of the cast is great too, but it's just a phenomenal performance. And I know Oscar talk is bullshit, but man, I would love to see her walk away with a statue.
Yeah. And speaking of Oscars, like, what I've been hearing for weeks, if not months at this point, is that this movie is like one of the front runners for Best Picture, if not the front runner. And just walking out of the theater with my wife on the way back to the car, I was like, I just can't imagine a world where that wins Best Picture. It's just so, it would be such an unusual Best Picture winner. But, you know, this is not an awards podcast.
We're living in a reality where Oppenheimer, Everything Everywhere All at Once, and Parasite all won Best Picture. So, who knows, Ben? They've been getting it right every so often in the past 5 years.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, so let's now pull the curtain back and talk fully about this movie. Specifically, I want to talk to you about the very end of the film, because the choice to end the way it does, I think, is a really interesting one. So what did you make of the ending of the movie? It kind of ends on a little bit of a dark note in a way.
Yeah, this is where I've had a lot of conversations about this ending and about whether it's a dark, bleak ending, or if it's actually hopeful. And I lean toward hopeful, and here's why. Because you go into the movie thinking that this is the story of Honora falling in love with this rich kid, and you keep expecting him to whisk her off her feet and learn to grow up and stand up for her. And that doesn't happen at all. He's such a piece of shit and revealed to be just a spoiled brat. And the real story of the movie is, on the worst day of her life, Honora meets Igor. That's the real... When the marketing describes Honora as a love story, that's the love story that's going on here. And I talked to my wife about this, because the first I noticed that Igor was like in love with Honora at one point in the movie, like deep into the running time. I asked my wife, "What did you notice?" And she said, "Oh yeah, I noticed, but she noticed much earlier than I did." I talked to other people, and everybody has a different point in the movie where they notice that Igor has fallen for Honora, and she has not realized it yet. And because the actor who plays him, he's very soft-spoken, he has very soulful eyes, and he's continues like being amused and bemused by everything that's happening around, with Honora, and he's like steadily grows, you know, more comfortable with her and more protective of her, and more willing to put himself on the line for her. Mm-hmm. And the emergence of this love story in the middle of this chaotic, feel-bad day for everybody is like this real lot, like hopeful light. And in the end, when she when they're having sex in the car and she breaks down, to me that is not like a hopeless situation. That is her being with the guy who is better for her, who's there for her, who's going to support her, and she's let her guard down after 2.5 hours of a movie where she's always playing a character, where she always has her guard up on high, where she's always posturing and being tough. She's with somebody who she can cry with and who she can grieve what she's lost with. And I think that is the breakthrough moment where her and Igor, maybe it lasts forever. Maybe it's a 2-week long romance. I don't know. But she has found a guy who she can be herself with. And that's why I think it's a hopeful ending.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the future holds for those two characters. If they're, you know, if the movie's trying to insinuate that they're going to be like the true love story and they're going to be the stable relationship, the stable couple that comes out of this whole nightmarish scenario. But I do think the first thing that I thought about this morning when I woke up, like my eyes woke up and I was like, huh, I feel like this movie, the ending of this movie is kind of like a death in some ways. It's a death of the Annie character that Anora was playing. Like, this movie is called Anora instead of Annie for a reason, I think. And I think the ending of the movie is her, the wall that you alluded to is finally breaking down. And it's like that entire persona that she created, the sex worker persona, the character that she's playing in those environments, because of this frenzied scenario that she just experienced and like coming so close to living the life that she thought she wanted. And even when that fell apart, coming so close to getting a big payout and like essentially winning in American society, like what that looks like, but then having that, even that yanked out from underneath her. I think it was too much for that persona to withhold and or withstand rather. And so I think the ending of the movie and that breakdown is the full transformation from Annie into Anora, which is a, you know, because Igor said earlier in the movie that he preferred that name. And she, again, had those walls up and was talking about like names don't really mean anything in this country. We don't confer meaning in the same way that other countries do. I just think that because of the title of the movie and because of all those things I said, that is what Sean Baker might have been trying to go for there. That was my read on the ending anyway.
No, I think that's a great read. I think that both of our reads on it are complementary. So I think we're both circling the same general idea, which is great. I love that the ending lets us have this conversation. But I want to talk about a more simple pleasure. The middle chunk of the movie where I don't even call them henchmen, the babysitters, Tauros, yeah. shows up to figure out what's going on with this marriage, even leaving behind a baptism, which is hilarious. this middle sequence of just long, extended physical comedy where Anora thinks she's in physical danger around guys who aren't playing the harmer, but everybody's misreading the situation, which leads to just this escalation of madcap physical insanity. Maybe the funniest sustained 25 minutes of anything this year.
Yeah, I think so. I was cracking up. Like, yeah, from Tauros receiving the phone call or the text or whatever it was during that baptism and sort of like squeaking out the word no as he realizes like the truth of what's going on in this house. Yeah, pretty much from that moment on, it's just this, yeah, incredibly sustained, high level, extreme comedy that, and there are like little flourishes of moments of like, oh, is Anora in real danger here? And I was so thankful that the movie didn't go there because a different type of movie absolutely could have gone a whole different way with that. But Sean Baker is not interested in that. He's like a humanist filmmaker. And he, at least in this film, I haven't seen all of his other work, but the tone of this movie, I think, walked that line pretty well where like you're not quite sure what these guys are going to do, but ultimately everything is okay in terms of like the physical violence or whatever, the threat of violence that kind of is hanging over that scene. And ultimately, Anora is the character is the character who's dishing out more violence than anybody. She's like biting and scratching and going nuts. And my God, yeah, just the way that scene like cuts to Tauros like running back and forth with the scarf, trying to gag her. And like just the pure craft of that on a comedic level is just so highly executed. I love that.
And the idea is that none of them are each other's enemies. Ultimately, they're all the tools of the same billionaire family who are calling the shots in all this. They're all the working class and all workers, and they're all being turned against each other by the forces of capitalism, even though they should be allies. And as they kind of weirdly become, I don't want to say friends, but friendlier, as they all realize that we're all in this together throughout the movie. Man, like as funny as the movie is, like it really is such a powerful allegory for like how workers need to take care of each other and realize that, hey, your fellow person out there grinding through their day is not your enemy. That's your ally in the fight against whatever the hell our future is.
Yeah, 100%. The courtroom scene is another high comedy moment that I just wanted to highlight real quick. A shout out to everyone who was involved in that. It was just like the way that the judge is handling what's his name, Vanya character being completely drunk in the courtroom, and how that scene ends with like him like literally laying on a table and like basically being like extracted from that scenario. Man, just the physical comedy and the writing and the sort of little improv, or what seemed to me to be like improv moments in that, it's just a really, really great stew that Sean Baker has stirred up for us. So despite like some of my maybe qualms with the way that the movie handles the roller coaster ride of those tonal switches, I think the highs are so incredibly high that it's just a super entertaining movie above anything else for me.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we're guilty as film critics or film writers or whatever of, you know, thinking this movie is too fun to be great, but Anora is not only great, but so much fun. Like for a 2.5 hour long movie, that's about, that has such a dark material floating through it. It really is the best time I had in the movie theater this year. Just it's such a great, it made me remember, like, sometimes you got to remember, why am I doing this? Why am I in this career? Why do I like movies so much? Why has this become a course of my life? I guess just that's just the nature of when, in our case, when movies become your job, it becomes like, it starts to feel like work. And Anora is the kind of thing that arrives, you know, once or twice a year, that sweeps all papers off your desk and goes, oh yeah, that's why I love this shit. And that's Anora for me.
Yeah. Okay. So before we wrap up and transition into the interview that Bill did with Sean Baker, I was just going to ask you, because you've seen it three times, was there something in the second or third viewing that you picked up on that you missed the first time around?
I don't want to say I missed these details, but I appreciate how when you first see Tauros and some of the other characters very early on, like sitting on the sidelines of Vanya's party, the first time you watch it, you think, oh, they're bodyguards. And the second time you watch it, you go, oh, no, they're babysitters. And details about how you start realizing that Igor's interest in Nora so much earlier. Like when you watch it again, his dialogue free reactions to her, where he starts to like become like charmed by her, it's so much earlier than I expected. Like that storyline's happening in the background for much longer than I initially thought. So just the little details are all there, and it rewards those multiple viewings for sure.
Excellent. Okay, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and get into Bill's interview with writer-director Sean Baker.
This is the story of the one who, as a maintenance specialist for a historic high-rise, knows that vintage charm historically needs constant attention. Which is why, when it's time to upgrade turn-of-the-century mechanicals, they turn to Grainger. With easy access to a million-plus products and the scale to deliver when and where you need them, the right tools and supplies are never far away. So the one can keep that vintage building running like new. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, man, how are you?
Good, man, how are you? Good. Congratulations on the film and the big Beyond Fest premiere last night.
Oh, thank you.
Did you get your trading card? The Beyond Fest
I did. I did. Yeah, I'm nice. Glad they used a 10-year-old photo. I look better.
We'll take that up with Patrick. So I wanted to first talk to you about how, I mean, this is a frequently hilarious movie. It's so fun and so funny at times. Your ensemble of actors that keep things at such a high farcical pitch. I wanted to ask about, did you get any rehearsal time with any of them? And especially maybe breaking down the fight struggle scene that's so extended in the middle of the film, that's so glorious. Like, how did that come about? Was it, you know, more on the fly, or was it really prepared and rehearsed?
We had more time to rehearse on this film than I've had with any of my previous films. And I really started to appreciate it early on in the process, so we kept it going. And we made sure, you know, there were many reasons. I just wanted to make sure we were always, there had to be a flow to every scene, so we had to make sure we nailed it before starting to roll the camera, because we're shooting film, you know. So rehearsals were very important and also just very informative. I was working with my entire main cast, and most of my supporting cast were seasoned, trained professionals, which is very kind of different from my my previous films where I like to mix it up. And in this case, everybody was came from years of you know, experience. And so they were really wonderful at giving me alts, you know, alternative takes, something different with every take. I was just getting, I was just amassing gold every day from these amazing actors. So to answer your question, yes, a lot of rehearsal, which also allowed us to do little rewrites on set and massage areas, you know, to make them work better. And then also, yeah, the set pieces that it required stunts or action, they had to be, they were calculated. They were very choreographed, you know, for many reasons. For example, the home invasion scene, I needed it to take place in real time. So I had to be covered so that there won't be any continuity errors. And then on top of that, there was stunt work, and that, and it could be dangerous, especially when my lead actors, you know, Mikey and Yura say, we want to do our own stunts. So, and I, as a director, that's wonderful. I mean, I'm seeing their faces that are performing these very scary stunts. But we had a stunt coordinator there, obviously, and a double ready to jump in case they couldn't do it. But my God, watching that for the first time was so, for me, it was shocking because we, I'm talking about especially that one wide shot where they come around the couch and Yura grabs Mikey and they fall back and the lamp goes and then she kicks the vase. There's just so much chaos in that one moment that I didn't fully realize until we were rolling the camera, because we had to, the way we rehearsed it was in quarter speed. You're going in slow motion just to show the path and what's going to happen. But then you're rolling and it's happening. And I was just incredibly impressed.
It's so impressive. It's such a beautiful moment.
Oh, thank you.
So many of your films involve characters who are either sex workers themselves or thinking of becoming one. You yourself have publicly advocated for the destigmatization and decriminalization of sex work.
Yes.
While making Anora, was there anything new that you discovered about sex workers in their world? Do you think things have improved or gotten worse, stayed the same? Where do you think that's at in terms of our society right now?
There have been slight improvements. I mean, the very fact that now we're, you know, using a new term, you know, it's, sex work is basically something that's come about in the last few years. I mean, before that, we would, you know, use terms like prostitution and others. But this blanket umbrella term, I think, really helps in many ways. And then also, well, to answer your question about what I've learned, every film is that I've covered on sex work is like a different aspect of sex work. So in this case, you know, this lap dance club, very foreign to me, and I had to learn the mechanics of that world. And that particular club allowed us to spend time there. We would spend time there with Mikey many a nights, just observing, watching. And then she was actually shadowing some of the dancers to really understand the interactions with clients and how everyone is different. Each one is different. And these young women in that situation, in that, you know, in that world, they have a lot. It's hard work. It's really hard work. They have to approach one of the men at the club or have the men approach them, and within seconds, read that person and figure out what they have to do, almost on a psychological level, to put that person at ease and then try to make some money from that person. It all has to happen in seconds. So in many ways, a lot of these, I think a lot of these young dancers working in an environment like that are psychiatrists, psychologists to a certain degree. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then on that same vein, what in your view do you think would help Hollywood stop being, unfortunately, so bad at tackling stories from stigmatized groups like sex workers, but also trans folks, those in poverty, you know, disabled, which you obviously do in your films?
I think it's really just about approaching the representation in a more respectful way. And what I mean by that is, you know, let's stop with the caricatures. Number one, let's use, meaning employ, sex workers as consultants. You know, it's their stories, it's their voice. You need to have them involved with this when you're doing this sort of thing. And then lastly, these characters should be human. They should be three-dimensional, fully fleshed out, and so that the audience can connect and identify and root for. And what that means is a fully fleshed out human that isn't sanctified, isn't put on a pedestal. They have flaws. They make mistakes, like all of us. And when we see that, you know, when people outside that world see that, they really see themselves. So I think that's the way to go about doing it.
Yeah. I love to get that's absolutely, I agree 100%.
Oh, cool.
One of the things that delighted me personally as just a film nerd is seeing in the credits a special thanks credit to Jess Franco and Soledad Moreno.
Yeah. Thank you. I love that. It's
that. I mean, what was it? Just the vibe of you know their films together that inspired you in this, or was it something more specific?
Yes, and well, specifically there is that red scarf that comes from Vampire Lesbos, in which Soledad Miranda wears it, and it becomes that prop. Becomes part of her character. Well, that's what we were doing with Annie. We were making that red scarf in a very important prop that is more than just a prop. It signifies in many ways her suppression in a way. You know, I mean, this thing is being used to silence her, you know, right. And yet then she has to use it for her own comfort and warmth. And so we're playing with that. And then also, you know, just I could have thanked a million filmmakers. I mean, you know, you probably see my influences there. I'm wearing them on my sleeve in this film. But I think it was also that relationship, how he shot Soledad Miranda in those couple of films that he made with her. I started to recognize that that's how I was shooting Mikey on the set, and she was literally in every shot of the entire film, just about, and so was Soledad in those movies. So I felt it was appropriate, and I also wanted to, you know, kind of call attention to those movies to general audiences who may never have heard of Jess Franco.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, you have had a direct impact on my cinematic life thanks to your Letterboxd account.
Oh, no.
Fernando de Leo's 2020 because of your bit.
Great.
And I was, you know, in the way that you approach your films like Anora, the fact that they are unflinching character studies, they aren't afraid of taboo material, so on and so forth. Are you trying to put a little bit of the word brazenness of European cinema and exploitation films of the 70s back into the American mainstream? Is that something that's a goal of yours, or is it just something you're interested in?
You know what? I think so. I think it is actually a goal, meaning that I'm missing that stuff. I'm missing that audacious, approach to storytelling, almost unapologetic, not in any way mean-spirited. I don't think mean-spirited. I think it's just we've lost the capability of laughing at ourselves and laughing at maybe perhaps dark humor, off-color humor. And I would love to see us get back there, you know? So yes, this time around, I think there was a more of a conscious, you know, this is what I'm doing here. And if it excites people again, if it reminds them of the way it used to be, that's what I'd love to see. Yeah.
Absolutely. Your films have such a specificity of place. I mean, you named one after Florida, for goodness sake. This one, I lived in New York City for 15 years, and I absolutely felt the vibe of the boroughs, the whole, you know, going to Coney Island at 2 a.m. sort of thing when it's freezing on the beach. How do you approach location work in your movies? Is it all, you know, scout? Do you guys have a really good scout who comes back to you with these ideas, locations? Is it from a script level?
With the script, and obviously I have to be familiar with the area, start to get familiar with the area, you know, whether that's before or during, you know, pre-production, us living in the Brightwater Towers, where Iger lives in the film, and really soaking in the environment, spending time in the environment, getting to know locals, and then, of course, when we're actually in production, shooting on location, trying my best, taking a cue from Scorsese and Taxi Driver, not to geographically cheat, though, you know, with cinema, you sometimes have to. You're forced, but try not to. And then, what else was I going to say about that? What was your actual question? Sorry, I had a little more.
It's about
there.
Like what is the process? Because obviously, it sounds like you start from a script level. You know, it's in your mind already.
Yeah.
But like, do you employ a lot of scouting, or is it more like?
Yes. Oh, thank you. That's it. Yeah, my scout, my location scout. He's amazing. Location manager Ross Broder. He got me every location I wanted. I mean, and it was collaborative. Like, for example, with the mansion, I just Googled biggest and best mansion in Brighton Beach, Google, and this thing came up, and I said, Ross, I need this one. I need it. And he got it for me, and we got the famous Tatiana's, and we were able to shoot outside of this, next to the Cyclone. You know, just really celebrating, I think, this really picturesque environment of Brighton Beach and Coney Island. And it's through the script stage, it's through working with my wonderful location manager, and then also it's while we're in production, really throwing our actors into real establishments, real restaurants, having them interact with real people on the street. I think that's what really brings it all together.
Yeah. And then just to wrap up, I know you are not in any way, shape, or form, not to put it on you, but you don't seem like a franchise filmmaker.
Yeah.
But you know that people like, you know, obviously Truffaut did the Antoine Donnell films. Mm. Were there any characters of your films that you've ever felt like revisiting? Would Nora be one?
Oh, that's interesting. I do have Easter eggs throughout all my movies that kind of pull them together. There's actually a Red Rocket Easter egg in Enora. I won't tell you what it is, but it's there. And that's interesting. You know, in many ways, you could say the Mikey character of Starlet is the Mikey character of Red Rocket, just played by two different actors. You could say that. But you know, we'll see. We'll see. I love all of my characters, and it's mostly because of the way that my wonderful actors have fleshed them out. So I would love to see any of them return. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I love your characters too, man. I can't wait to see the next one.
Thanks, man. Thank you so much.
All right, Jacob, any closing thoughts on Enora? I mean, I'm guessing we'll probably be talking about this movie in some capacity again as the award season ticks on or whatever. I just wanted to shout out another scene, the candy store scene, like the with those friends characters. I mean, the Vegas trip alone was just like wealth porn of the unimaginable variety, you know, just like, oh my God, I can't believe when they go into that that hotel room that where like all the liquor bottles are laid out. It's just like, man, this is like pure fantasy type of stuff. But then contrast that with the, again, like the sort of worker centric, like these people are just working what seemed to be like almost summer jobs or something. I know this movie takes place in winter, but like at this little candy store where like the owner is just kind of like blitzed out of his mind. It doesn't really care about anything. And then things escalate and all the candy stuff gets smashed and bats are being swung around. And it's just like, this movie is frenzied on a level that is unlike anything else I've seen this year. But any other scenes or moments or aspects of the film that you wanted to call out before we close it out?
I just think that the first chunk of the movie, which is the romance of Vanya, is a really entertaining whirlwind. But once the main cast are all together, Vanya's escaped, and Mikey and Enora and these three guys are crowded into an SUV. It gets increasingly horrible. It gets full of puke. It gets messed up. it just becomes this, like, the most unlikely, like, New York City one night in hell comedy. And I just, like, the trailers do not sell it as being that, and I'm so glad they didn't, because it was such a pleasant surprise to see that, oh, this is what the movie is. It's about these four people trapped in an SUV going on this an absolute horrible manhunt, and I loved it so much.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. I'm going to link to Jacob's review of Anora, and you can find that in the show notes and get more into his thoughts there. You can find more about Anora at slashfilm.com. I think we have a few other articles up about the film, and if we don't by now, then we probably will very shortly. Slash Film Daily is typically published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. We'd really appreciate that. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.